and welcome to the reading of the Sioux City Journal newspaper, dated Wednesday, November the 16th, and I'm your reader, Kevin Boucher. Headline, man arrested in Salix bank robbery linked to other crimes. And this article was written by reporter Earl Horlick. Sioux City police arrested a man on multiple felony charges related to area robberies at around 12:30 p.m. on Monday. Multiple law enforcement agencies were alerted to a robbery occurring at Pioneer Bank in Salix, Iowa. Kevin Demetrios Spratt was taken into custody after trying to flee the scene. Spratt is believed to have been involved in an October 24th robbery that took place at Check Into Cash, 17 Hamilton Boulevard. He is also suspected in other armed robberies in both Sergeant Bluff and Salix, Iowa. Spratt was booked into the Woodbury County Jail and charged with robbery in the first degree, possession of a weapon as a felon, and trafficking in stolen weapons. The Woodbury County Sheriff's Office and Sergeant Bluff Police Department assisted in this case. Headline, Sioux City Public Schools fall behind with English language learners, students with disabilities. And this article was written by reporter Caitlin Yamada. State performance results show the Sioux City Community School District needs to make improvements in educating students with disabilities and those who are learning English. These results from various statewide assessments, which were recently completed, show that Sioux City public schools are mostly staying the same in performance from year to year, but drops in performance are frequently related to IEP, Individualized Education Plan, students, and English language learners. In English language arts and math, the district is still mostly ahead of their peers, but their peers are catching up. On Monday, Associate Superintendent Angela Bemis presented the Sioux City School District performance in the Iowa School Performance Profile, Every Student Succeeds Act designations, and the Iowa Assessments, all of which are ways to determine how Iowa school districts are performing. And Bemis said that each performance assessment shows a different story about the district, but not the entire story. The school board members on Monday said the data presented showed problems or leaks that need to be worked on in the school district. In October, the Iowa Department of Education's annual Iowa School Performance Profile was released, which gives each school a rating based on factors that include standardized test scores, attendance, staff retention and expulsion, and suspension rates, and the entire school district. Schools receive a score of up to 100 and are placed in one of six rating categories. They are exceptional, high-performing, commendable, acceptable, needs improvement, and priority. A majority of Sioux City schools stayed in the same category as last year, with a few of the schools moving up or down one category. The data shows that Bryant Elementary, Nodland Elementary, and Sunnyside Elementary dropped a whole category, while Irving Elementary, Leeds Elementary, and Liberty Elementary moved up a category. The district's virtual school has been identified as a priority school, which means it's in the bottom 5% of schools in the state. Many other virtual schools in Iowa ranked at the bottom 5%, including Cedar Rapids Virtual Academy, Des Moines Virtual Campus, Iowa City Online Learning Program, Marshalltown Virtual Academy, Mason City Virtual Academy, Olowen Online School, Oskaloosa Virtual Academy, and Ottumwa Virtual Learning. The performance profiles were presented side by side with the Every Student Succeeds Act data. The ESSA is used to identify schools that need support and improvement. Schools are identified for the ESSA categories based on student participation in Iowa assessments, student education growth, graduation rates, progress in English language efficiency, and conditions for learning, according to the Iowa Department of Education. And like the progress report, the schools are scored and placed into certain categories like targeted and comprehensive. Targeted schools mean the school has one or more student subgroups in the lowest 5% of schools, and the subgroups are free or reduced lunch students, English learners, students with disabilities, or students in certain race or ethnicity groups. And Bemis said the school could have a good overall score, but if there are subgroups of students falling in the bottom 5%, they will be classified as a targeted school. Comprehensive means the high school has a graduation rate below 61.7%, and that the school is in the lowest 5% of Title I schools in the state of Iowa. Vibe Academy has been identified as a comprehensive school with the subgroups of English language learners, Hispanic, white, IEP, and free and reduced lunch students, all in the lowest 5% of schools. Now, this is the first time the district has made a comprehensive school, Bemis said. And she said this means the school administrative team will meet with state representatives once a month. Leeds Elementary, Los Hills Elementary, and Spalding Park Elementary enter the targeted category this year. Irving Elementary, Morningside Elementary, Unity Elementary, West Middle, North Middle, and West High School continued to be in the targeted categories. School board member Jan George gave this opinion, said that he believes the recent implementation of the teaming concept at the middle school will increase test scores and improve the entire school district. Teaming pairs a group of teachers with a group of students to build relationships and allow the teachers a better understanding of how these specific students are performing and to learn more accurately what areas these students need more support. And Denny, Director of Curriculum, Instruction, and Assessment, presented the teaming concept as a way to address school scoring. She also said, teaming has been introduced to the freshman and sophomore classes at the high school, and Denny presented other ways the district is responding to the data results. The response is including decreasing assessments throughout the district to increase instructional time, making sure all core classes have curriculum resources, focusing on student engagement, creating an IEP task force, and identifying needs in the English language learning curriculum. And again, that was an article about the recent test results and rankings of Sioux City's schools, and that story was written by reporter Caitlin Yamada. And the headline for this next article: Calumet man sentenced to prison for shooting at his wife. And this article was written by reporter Nick Hytrek. A Calumet, Iowa man was sentenced on Monday to 15 years in prison for shooting at his wife during a domestic disturbance. Paul Long, 41, pleaded guilty in September in O'Brien County District Court to intimidation with a dangerous weapon and willful injury resulting in bodily injury. The charges were amended as a part of a plea agreement from attempted murder and domestic abuse assault. Two other counts of domestic abuse assault were also dismissed. Long struck his wife in the head with the butt of a 12-gauge shotgun and then fired a shot at her as she ran from a house in the 200 block of South Morse Avenue in Calumet during the February 13th incident. Long was involved with a short standoff with authorities who responded to the incident. He later exited the home and was taken into custody by the police. According to court documents, in addition to striking his wife with a gun, Long also choked her three times with his hands during this assault. And the headline for this next article, written by the Lincoln Journal Star newspaper: Lincoln woman crashes while fleeing state patrol on Interstate 80. A 28-year-old Lincoln woman is in jail after she crashed her car while fleeing Nebraska State Patrol troopers on Interstate 80 at speeds higher than 100 miles an hour Tuesday afternoon, according to the patrol. A trooper initially tried to stop the woman's Pontiac Grand Am at 3:20 p.m. on Tuesday after the 28-year-old passed other vehicles on the shoulder of eastbound 80 while driving more than just 110 miles an hour just west of Lincoln. And that's according to the state patrol in the news release that they sent. 2 minutes after troopers began to chase the woman, her Pontiac careened off the interstate, struck a road sign, and came to rest in a ditch near mile marker 394 just west of Lincoln, the patrol said. The woman, who the patrol said was not injured in the crash, was arrested on suspicion of willful reckless driving, flight to avoid arrest, and no operator's license. Troopers took the 28-year-old to the Lancaster County Jail. And here is the latest Woodbury County, Iowa court report as compiled and reported by reporter Nick Hytrick. Before Judge Robert Tiefenthaler, Devin Van Haas, 33, of Sioux City, possession of a controlled substance, third offense, sentenced on November the 8th to 5 years prison suspended, 2 years probation. Jeffrey Rieger, 60, of Sioux Falls, eluding, operating while intoxicated, second offense, sentenced November 9th, 5 years in prison. Valerie Rodriguez, 20, of Sioux City, second-degree criminal mischief, sentenced October 27th, deferred judgment, 2 years probation. Jennifer Lynn Stinton, 49, Sioux City, possession of a controlled substance, third offense, sentenced November the 8th to 5 years in prison. Carter David Crum, 23, of Mobile, Iowa, third-degree burglary, trafficking in a stolen weapon, sentenced on November the 7th, deferred judgment, 3 years probation. Jason Matthew Green, 41, of Sioux City, attempted third-degree burglary, sentenced November 7th to 20 days in jail. And Justin Darnell Kitchen, 19, of South Sioux City, credit card fraud, sentenced November the 8th to 60 days in jail. Dustin Ray Lesline, 43, of Sioux City, possession of a controlled substance, third offense, sentenced November the 9th, 5 years prison suspended, 2 years probation. Seth Ryan Maurer, 28, of Lamars, Iowa, possession of a controlled substance, third offense, sentenced November 3rd, 5 years prison suspended, 3 years probation. Alex James Niedermeyer, 27, of Vanawa, Iowa, second-degree theft, sentenced November the 9th, 5 years prison suspended, and 2 years probation. Headline for this next article, Galva man arrested and charged with murder and stabbing death of his brother. And this story was written by reporter Dolly Butts. A man has been arrested in connection with the Sunday stabbing death of his brother in Galva. Jesus Isaiah Diaz, 24, of Galva, is charged with first-degree murder. He is accused of killing 26-year-old Art Eduardo Diaz III of Holstein. Ida County Sheriff Wade Harriman told the Journal Monday that the two men are brothers. At 7:33 p.m., the Ida County Communications Center received a call concerning a fight in progress on Main Street in Galva. When sheriff's deputies arrived at the scene, they discovered a man, later identified as Eduardo Diaz III, lying on a sidewalk in the 200 block of South Main Street. The Ida County Medical Examiner pronounced him dead at the scene. According to a criminal complaint filed in Ida County District Court, Jesus Diaz became involved in a physical altercation with Eduardo Diaz outside his residence in the 200 block of South Main Street. Jesus Diaz stabbed his brother multiple times in the chest and abdomen. Then Eduardo Diaz collapsed and died on the sidewalk. Witnesses observed Jesus punching and kicking the unresponsive body of Eduardo Diaz. Jesus crossed the street and then returned to continue beating on his brother's dead body, the complaint states. When arrested, Jesus' clothing was covered in blood. Diaz also allegedly assaulted a witness and EMS personnel who were responding to 911 calls concerning the incident. Before the EMS crew arrived, the complaint said the witness observed Diaz placing items into his white Cadillac, which was parked in front of the residence. At the time, his brother was lying unresponsive on the ground. A search later of the Cadillac turned up a bloody knife in the rear seat, according to police. Headline for this next article, Sioux City Utilities Director says there are uncertainties abounding with forever chemicals in the water. And this story was written by reporter Dolly Butts. Sioux City Utilities Director Brad Poites told the City Council on Monday that per- and polyfluoroalkyl substances are very difficult to get rid of, and that experts don't know the concentration at which these forever chemicals are harmful to the human body. They do not decay in the environment, and they basically stick around forever. There's very few ways to actually dispose of PFAS, says Poites, who emphasized that the city is committed to transparency regarding these dangerous substances. We want the citizens to know everything that we know. Sioux City's drinking water has exceeded health advisory levels in recent months for PFAS, which is a class of compounds composed of more than 6,000 chemicals which have been used in products that are resistant to heat and repel oil and water. And since the levels are not regulatory in nature, Poites said the city is not in violation of anything. He said residents can continue drinking the water and feel safe about it. Roughly a dozen water utilities in Iowa, thousands around the nation, and many more worldwide are dealing with these chemicals in the drinking water, according to Poites. These chemicals are in your burger wrappers. These chemicals are in your microwave popcorn packages. These chemicals are in your pizza boxes, said Poites, who also noted that PFAS were present in Scotchgard and water-resistant clothing, such as the popular Gore-Tex. In December of 2021, Poites said that the 185th Air National Guard tested for PFAS on its base and then expanded the testing to additional well sites, including the Southbridge Collector Well. And in January, Poites said the city started to test for PFAS on its own. The source of Sioux City's contamination is the use of firefighting foams on the base. Those concentrations on the base are extremely high. And what we've found is the firefighting foams have entered the groundwater, and they've migrated off-site to the Southbridge Collector Well, Poites said. Although PFAS have been detected in Southbridge, Poites said the chemicals have not been found in water samples collected from several wells on the riverfront. The riverfront water supply provides between 85% and 90% of the community's water. The majority of this water is not even being used, Mayor Bob Scott said of the water containing PFAS. He continues, that should make people feel a little bit more comfortable about this. In August, the city began participating in an Iowa Department of Natural Resources program to proactively determine the prevalence of PFAS in its drinking water. A water sample collected that month indicated 4.4 parts per trillion of one PFOS compound. And then in October, sample results detected perfluorocotanic acid, or PFOA for short, in a concentration of 5.4 parts per trillion and PFOs in a concentration of 4 per trillion. The EPA's new interim health advisory levels are 0.004 parts per trillion for some of the chemicals. Poites said the EPA's decision to lower the health advisory levels by nearly 12,500 times stunned the water community. Currently, 75% of laboratories testing for PFAS can only report with 95% confidence to a level of 4 parts per trillion, according to Poites. And he compared the levels of PFAS in Sioux City's drinking water to 4 drops of water in an Olympic-sized swimming pool. It's very difficult to surmise why EPA took such a drastic move in lowering the levels, he said. I think they're trying to make a statement about PFAS. They want it taken care of. According to the EPA, the interim health advisory levels were calculated to offer a margin of protection against adverse health effects and also to take into account other potential sources of exposure to PFAS beyond drinking water. Studies have found associations between these chemicals and the effects on the immune system, cardiovascular system, human development, and these chemicals have even been linked to cancer. And Poit said the EPA's final rule is expected to be published by the end of 2023, with enforcement set to begin in the fall of 2026. And he said there's a chance the EPA will increase the health advisory level, but cautioned that it won't go back to anything close to 70 parts per trillion. And the headline for this next article from the Sioux City Journal: Siouxland man sought on federal probation charge. And this article was written by reporter Earl Horlick. The U.S. Marshal Service Northern Iowa Fugitive Task Force is seeking the following person: Jeffrey Korowitz, 34. He is 6 feet 1 inch tall and weighs 175 pounds. Korowitz is wanted by the U.S. Marshal Service for violations of his federal probation. He is on federal probation for possession with intent to distribute methamphetamine. He was last known to be living in Spencer, Iowa. The Marshal Service wants the public to call 712-252-0211 with any information. And once again, that telephone number, 712-252-0211. And here is a fun seasonal story, the headline for this next story: Sioux City gets ready for downtown for the holidays. And this article was written by reporter Earl Horlick. The best seat in downtown Sioux City may be on a bench that is in the shape of 2 polar bears. At least that's the opinion of Downtown Partners Executive Director Reagan Cote. The polar bear bench is located right in front of downtown for the holidays Christmas tree at the Sioux City Public Museum, she explained, in front of an evergreen at 607 4th Street. And that'll be where our lighted parade ends and Santa Claus makes his appearance. If I could, I'd call dibs for the polar bear bench in advance, Cote added with a smile. In the event, the Downtown for the Holidays Christmas Parade has become sort of like the informal start of the Christmas season in Sioux City. There will be plenty of kid-friendly activities going on at the Children's Museum as well as the Sioux City Public Library located at 529 Pierce Street. If you want to warm up a bit, Evolve Yoga, 411 Pearl Street will be offering hot chocolate. And chances are you'll need a steamy beverage prior to the start of the International Brotherhood of Electrical Workers, Local 231's annual Holiday Lighted Parade. And it starts at 6:15 p.m. on 4th and Iowa Streets, and the parade will end on Nebraska Street. This year's parade may be the biggest one in our history, Cote said. We already have more than 50 entries and will no doubt be getting many more. And if you and the family are watching the parade and you get hungry, well, get your choice of food, Hardline Coffee Company, 515 4th Street, and the Sioux City Convention Center, 801 4th Street, will have festive treats for sale. While Remax Preferred Stocking Caps will be available free of charge near 4th and Jones Streets. Now, once the parade ends, Jolly old St. Nicholas will hold court at Santa's house, which is located this year at 422 Pierce Street. While Santa's house, which is sponsored by Unity Point Health St. Luke's, has been going on for the past 34 Christmases, this will be the 29th year for the annual Festival of Trees. Visitors can vote for their favorite holiday trees beginning at 6 p.m. inside the Ho-Chunk Center Atrium, 604th Street. A live auction conducted by veteran auctioneer Bruce Brock will take place at 6:30 p.m. on December 1st, with the proceeds going to the Siouxland Foster Closet. And a new event this year will be a slate of holiday movies at Promenade Cinema 14, 924 4th Street. And those movies will run December 1st through the 12th, with ticket sales benefiting the food bank of Siouxland. And during the holidays, everybody is in a charitable mood, Coates said. There are so many nonprofit organizations that can use your help. For instance, the Holiday Storefront Decorating Competition is an opportunity for businesses and nonprofits to transform vacant downtown spaces into beautiful displays. People will be able to vote for their favorite space between November 21st and December 26th at downtownsiouxcity.com, Coates said. The winner will receive a $500 donation going to the nonprofit of their choice. And in summation, Coates adds, you know, there's just something nostalgic about shopping for Christmas in your own hometown, she said. This is shaping up into being a terrific holiday for all of us. And again, the parade, the Downtown Partners, and the International Brotherhood of Electrical Workers, IBEW Local 231, are presenting the Downtown for the Holidays Lighted Parade. Starts at 6:15 p.m. on November 21st. Again, the parade, November 21st, at 4th and Iowa Streets. Parade route, they will head west to Nebraska Street. Other activities as a part of this include special activities at Launchpad Children's Museum in the Sioux City Public Library on November the 21st. Santa's house will open the same day, and then so will the 29th annual Festival of Trees. And the headline for this next article, Lincoln Veterans Parade Recognizes Service Women. And this article was written by Damond Bennett, a reporter for the Lincoln Journal Star newspaper. People lined K Street this past Sunday, bundled head to toe as a cold wind blew during the 4th annual Lincoln Veterans Parade. The wind also brought change this year as a procession to the Capitol honored women who are veterans. For Michelle Greenwood, that change is long overdue. "It's about time," said Greenwood. She is an Army veteran who served in Operation Desert Storm. "And since I got in 1983, I can tell you that being a woman veteran back then was difficult." She said she would sometimes be told she wasn't even a real veteran. But on Sunday, Greenwood was aboard a float filled with women, all of them veterans. Next to her sat sisters Laura Campbell and Kyanne Sheets. Campbell served in Afghanistan in 2011, and Sheets is still an active duty member of the Army National Guard who has served time serving your country in Guantanamo Bay, Cuba. "I'm thankful that it's happening," Sheets said. "When you're in your unit, you're definitely the minority as a female, and right now, though, we're not the minority." In recognition of women in the service, Sunday's parade included an all-female Offutt Honor Guard, retired Nebraska National Guard Brigadier General Roma Amundson as Grand Marshal, and U.S. Air Force veteran Terry Clark as a guest speaker. Amundson became the first woman in the National Guard to be promoted to Brigadier General in 2009 and retired in 2011, after 33 years of service. Amundson stood on a small stage in front of the steps of the Capitol and told the stories of women that served in every war since the U.S. Revolution. You are listening to the reading of the Sioux City Journal newspaper dated Wednesday, November the 16th on IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind. And now, let's turn to today's obituaries. Ronnie Ron Berg, 69 years old, of Sioux City, died on Friday, November the 11th, 2022. Services November 19th at 11 a.m. at the Faith United Presbyterian Church in Sioux City. Arrangements with Waterbury Funeral Service of Sioux City. Fritz Brandt, 81, of Sioux City, died on November the 4th. Services will be held November 23rd at 1 p.m. at Waterbury Funeral Service of Sioux City, 4125 Orleans Avenue. Elizabeth Betty Hansen, 88 years old, of Kingsley, Iowa, died on Friday, November 11th. Services are pending with Road Funeral Home in Kingsley. Richard L. Lindberg, 74, of Sergeant Bluff, passed away on Wednesday, November 9th, at a local hospital. Waterbury Funeral Service of Sergeant Bluff is assisting the family with arrangements. Richard Lindberg was born December 9th, 1947, in Grand Forks, North Dakota. The son of Lowell and Viola Christensen Lindberg, he moved with his family to Sergeant Bluff, where he graduated from Sergeant Bluff Luton High School. In 1966, he joined the Navy and later served in the Air National Guard, retiring after 20 years. Richard married Judy Licato in August of 1970. They later divorced. He married Arlene Stibrel in September of 1976, and she later passed in 2002. Richard married Karen Martin in November of 2003. Richard was a Sioux City fireman for over 31 years, and as a final gesture of his amiable and generous nature, he donated tissue and bone to the Iowa Donor Network. He was a member of the Westminster Presbyterian Church, where he enjoyed singing in the choir. Richard was also a member of the Siouxland Discovery Chorus, also known as the Barbershoppers. He is survived by his wife, Karen Lindberg, three children, Christina and Craig Heron, David Lindberg, and Troy and Erica Lindberg, six grandchildren, four great-grandchildren, and two sisters, Andre and Don Tollefson, and Mary Ann Shoup. It was preceded in death by his parents, wife Arlene, and an infant sister, Catherine. In lieu of flowers, memorials may be directed to the Siouxland Discovery Chorus or the Westminster Presbyterian Church. David Menard, 86, of Sergeant Bluff, Iowa, passed away on Monday, November 7, 2022, after a long battle with cancer. Waterbury Funeral Service of Sergeant Bluff is assisting the family with arrangements. David Menard was born on November 6, 1936, in Sioux City, the son of Joel and Grace Owen Menard. He was raised on a farm that he loved near Sergeant Bluff. David graduated from Sergeant Bluff Luton High School and continued his education at the University of Nebraska and at Morningside College. On January 16, 1960, David married his high school sweetheart, Shirley Lucier, and together they made their home in Sergeant Bluff. In June 1960, David joined the Army Reserve. He was honorably discharged in 1966, and over the years he worked in the building supply business as a salesman. David loved people and enjoyed calling on his customers. He was a hard worker, a straight shooter, and was well liked by his customers as he formed many lifelong friendships. In the late 1980s, he found his passion and together with his wife, Shirley, built, owned, and operated Menards Self-Storage in Sergeant Bluff. He loved owning his own business and would often say that he never had a bad day as he was working at his mini-storage property. David was a lifelong member of St. Joseph's Catholic Church in Salix and a member of the Kiwanis Club. David loved spending time with and raising his family, and he was always involved with his kids' school activities and never missed a track or a wrestling meet. He enjoyed a beautiful retirement, spending his winters in Arizona with his wife, Shirley, golfing with his friends, and woodworking. He spent many hours in his shop creating beautiful wooden boxes and many other works of art using exotic and hard-to-find wood. He is survived by his wife, Shirley, four children, Bradley and Angela Menard, Cynthia and Steve Polich, Julie and Don Van Dyke, and Joel and Chen Menard, nine grandchildren, Leslie, Ryan, Justin, Ben, Michelle, Jordan, Chris, Kyle, and Caleb, 12 great-grandchildren, and also one sister, Beth Hickey. He was preceded in death by his parents and three siblings, Artel, Constance, and Owen. And the family will direct memorials to St. Joseph Catholic Church or Sergeant Bluff Luton Track Scholarship. Robert Paul Rob Seeler, 59, of Sioux City, died on Saturday, November the 5th. The services will be held November 23rd at 10:30 a.m. at the Blessed Sacrament Catholic Church. Meyer Brothers Colonial Chapel is in charge of local arrangements. John D. Young, 93, of Sioux City, died on Friday, November the 11th. Services are pending with Meyer Brothers Colonial Chapel. Richard L. Lindbergh, 74, of Sergeant Bluff, died on Wednesday, November the 9th. Arrangements are with Waterbury Funeral Service of Sergeant Bluff. Darlene Means, 96, of Marcus, Iowa, died on Tuesday, November the 8th. Arrangements are with Ernest and Johnson Funeral Home in Marcus. Christina Louise Merchant, 41 years old, of Sioux Falls, South Dakota, formerly of South Sioux City, died on Monday, November the 7th. Moore and Becker Hunt Funeral Home in South Sioux City is in charge of arrangements. Jeanette M. Thomas, 74, of Sioux City, died on November the 8th. Meyer Brothers Colonial Chapel is in charge of local arrangements. Curtis Utesh, 75, of Lamars, Iowa, died on Tuesday, November the 8th. The Maurer Johnson Funeral Home of Lamars is in charge of arrangements. Janice Jan Betton, 74, of Sergeant Bluff, died on Sunday, November the 6th. Arrangements are with Eldridge Family Funeral Home in Paulina, Iowa. And now, on my reading of the Sioux City Journal newspaper for November the 16th, turning now to the opinion page of the newspaper. Our opinion: Republican red wave in Siouxland bucked the national trend. And this opinion piece was written by the editorial board of the Sioux City Journal. We can be thankful the backbiting season of election season is over. Yes, it'll be just a minute before we start with the 2024 presidential speculation, but now we should exhale, enjoy the relative calm, and reflect on what has transpired. In Iowa, Nebraska, and South Dakota, there was a red wave. Republicans won so many seats in state offices that increased their dominance in the state. But that was not the case in other parts of the country. President Joe Biden, in fact, was bragging it was the best midterm performance in decades for a party holding the White House. Candidates backed by Donald Trump didn't do as well as the former president had hoped. While the House and Senate still seem to be question marks, there might be enough balance to actually prompt, quote, reaching across the aisle. In Siouxland, that's not the case. So few Democrats won office in our three states that they won't be able to stop the Republican agenda. Now, certainly some of the issues that Democrats touted have merit, but without strong voices in the state's legislatures, it'll be difficult for their voices to be heard. Where did the Democrats go wrong? Number one, they needed to counterattack. Instead of promoting social issues, they needed to combat the idea that gas and grocery prices, which are high, were a Biden thing. The president does not have control in those areas, but Republicans made sure they tied him to them. You don't like paying more at the pump? Vote Republican. Democrats should have known the economy would be a key issue. Instead, they ignored it. They didn't address the Trump in the room. Pointing out the former president's failings might have planted some concern and helped get their message out. Waiting for the January 6th committee to do something was naive, and as soon as Trump ranted about Florida Governor Ron DeSantis, Republicans, including newly re-elected Iowa Senator Chuck Grassley, took to Twitter to suggest the former president might want to cool it and exit with some class. Those party faithful should have said something long before now. The Democrats should have. Number three, the Democrats had no stars. As loyal to the party as some of the Democratic candidates may have been, they just didn't have the sizzle that was behind some of the Republicans. To make a dent in 2024, they need to target potential candidates now. And waiting until they hold a convention is too late. Look at individual communities and see who's getting the attention. Then, do what the Republicans did. Groom them. If Republican pseudo-celebrities can get votes, why can't Democrats do that same thing? What do the Republicans need to do? Avoid the issues that have never been a problem in our three states. The transgender kerfluffle was just a way to rile people up. Name one transgender athlete who won a state athletic competition. You can't. It was a non-issue. Be more gracious. Some of the vitriol that was coming out of candidates' mouths near the election was unnecessary, particularly since they won by significant margins. Number three, don't avoid the public or the media. Grassley and Reynolds were great at visiting the state's 99 counties, but they did not want to hear questions from those who weren't supporters. Similarly, they often ignored media requests for interviews. Why not engage? Members of both parties need to remember they're representing all of the people of the state and not just those who got them into office. Ambitions shouldn't be their motivators. Constituents should. And this next opinion piece is a letter to the editor from Christina Long of Mobile, Iowa. Headline, "The Elections Validate or Reject the Cultural Climate." My thoughts on the recent election. Tuesday night, November 8th, mixed bag validated an insight that I had years back on why I just didn't have the emotional energy to pursue politics. And that is, the end goal of winning was not enough. The climate in which we'd live was always going to lead back to culture. I think back to 2012 when evangelicals were blamed for Romney not getting the presidential vote. In hindsight, and I voted for him, those who didn't were right. Elections aren't about winning. They're about worldview. And given the recent midterm election results, as with them, elections validate or reject the current cultural climate. And then when Republicans don't understand that, they lose. One thing for sure, it was a net loss for Donald Trump, an exception of perhaps maybe Arizona. DeSantis' referendum against COVID stand, the institutional left, and their handlers, by contrast, swept Florida. The 2024 premise was set high during the elections, and the next 2 years will witness what will win out, the left's worldview or the outright rejection of it. And because the middle ground, who believe this is still about winning elections, lost. We are in a culture war. We've always been. And for the good that Trump has been pre-COVID, he simply doesn't see or acknowledge for his part how we got there. I wish he would just step aside rather than run, but alas, I'll be nonetheless a fascinating and harrowing next 2 years of tension and delicate balance between what we as a people seek in common versus what will tear us apart. And again, that opinion piece, Letter to the Editor, was written and submitted by Christina Lang of Mobile, Iowa. And the headline for the next opinion piece, legislators cannot tell judges to ignore the most material facts in setting bail. And this piece is written by regular contributor John Donald O'Shea. Beginning in 2023, Illinois will have a new law governing pretrial release on bond. Prosecutors are decrying the new law, labeling it cashless bail. While the new law is hardly a model of clarity, I'm not sure that it mandates cashless bail. So, as a starting point, let's look at Illinois' bail law that was in effect during my judgeship. In the 26 years when I was on the bench, bail in Illinois criminal cases was governed by the Illinois Code of Criminal Procedure. And the difference between the 10% bond and the recognizance bond was simple. If the judge set a cash bail for the pretrial release of the accused, if the bond was set at, say, $5,000, the defendant had to post $500 to be released. But if the judge allowed the defendant to be released on a $5,000 recognizance bond, the defendant merely signed his name and was required not to post any money. Now, regardless of the form of the bond, if the defendant violated his bond, the bond could be forfeited and a judgment entered against the defendant for the full amount of his bond, in this case, $5,000. Between 1990 and 2000, when I was presiding judge in criminal courts, release on recognizance was the expressed legislative preference. For example, for a Class 4 felony cannabis offense, if the defendant had no prior record, the state would almost always agree to the defendant's bond being a recognizance. But on the other hand, if the defendant was already on bond, probation, or parole when the new felony offense was committed, or if the defendant's record suggested that he was unlikely to appear for a trial or likely to commit additional offenses if released on bond, the 10% bond was used. That was also true in more serious felonies, such as burglary, robbery, and some of the larger thefts. My rule of thumb as a judge was to release the accused on recognizance if asked to do so, unless his record suggested that A, he was likely to jump bond, or B, his pretrial release would create a danger to law-abiding citizens and or their property. And so the new Senate bill begins by stating the General Assembly recognizes that the promotion of public safety and protection of crime victim rights are two of the main focuses of our state's criminal justice system. It further acknowledges that protecting the rights of the accused is central to the integrity of our state's criminal justice system. In determining the amount of monetary bail or conditions of release, if any, which will reasonably assure the appearance of a defendant as required or the safety of any other person in the community, and the likelihood of compliance by the defendant with all of the conditions of the bail, the court shall, on the basis of available information, take into account such matters as some of these factors. Will the public be safe if the defendant is free, or will the defendant move to another state? The courts of Illinois now have jurisdiction over all justiciable matters. The courts in Illinois now have jurisdiction, and again, the legislature cannot tell a court how a case must be decided, or that clearly relevant evidence isn't. A statute that tells a court it cannot consider evidence that any reasonable judge would find material, and which the legislature itself says is a main focus in the matter, is an unconstitutional and an interference with the inherent powers of the court to provide a just result in the matter before the court. And we'll read one more from the opinion page. This is by contributor Suzanne Stewart. Headline: Role Model Reminds Us of the Help We Could Give. In today's column, I want to tell the story of one man whose dogged determination made a difference for our country and also for my family. Like all Boy Scouts, Steve Ryrie liked to hike. Starting in 1972, he climbed Mount Charleston, about a half hour outside of Las Vegas, Nevada. The top of the mountain was riddled with plane crash debris, and he learned that there had been a fatal crash in 1955, so he tried to learn more. It was not until 1998 that he learned the CIA accident report had been declassified, and it described the November 17, 1955 crash of U.S. Air Force Flight 9068 bound from Burbank, California for Watertown, Nevada, now known as Area 51. All 14 passengers died. The passengers were on their way to test the U-2 spy plane. Radio transmissions couldn't be used because of the fear of Soviet interception, and an early winter snowstorm developed. The pilot became disoriented, and eventually the plane drifted off course and impacted dead center at the highest point in the Spring Mountain Range, which was Mount Charleston. And that was written by Susan Stewart. She is a retired corporate attorney. And during the 40 years she has lived in Sioux City, she has been involved in a variety of local and state volunteer activities. And turning now to sports from the Sioux City Journal. At Kinnick Stadium in Iowa City, Iowa, this past weekend, a home crowd saw the Iowa Hawkeyes football team beat the Wisconsin Badgers. Final score from this past Saturday, Iowa 24, Wisconsin 10. The Iowa Hawkeyes now have a record of 6-4 overall and a Big Ten Conference record of 4-3, which gives them a first-place tie in the conference. They're tied with three other teams with identical records, by the way. Iowa Hawkeyes' next game is at the Minnesota Golden Gophers this coming Saturday, September the 19th, and as of right now, the start time is not known yet. And also, Saturday in Stillwater, Oklahoma, the Iowa State Cyclones played the Oklahoma State Cowboys and lost. The final from November the 12th, Oklahoma State 20, Iowa State 14. Iowa State, they're now 4-6 overall, but they are last in the Big 12 Conference with a conference record of 1 win and 6 losses. And next up for Iowa State, a home game this Saturday against Texas Tech. And that does it for today's reading of the Sioux City Journal newspaper. And I'm your reader, Kevin Boucher. The newspaper that I have been reading for you was Wednesday, November the 16th. You know, you can access a recording of today's reading on our website, iowaradioreading.org at any time. Thanks for listening.